Hello and welcome to the Wisden Cricket Weekly podcast. We've got a bumper show for you today, folks. Lots planned. We'll talk the Women's Ashes, England v Ireland, Zimbabwe cricket, Darren Stevens, the T20 blast, Lassie Thmelinga, wicketkeeping, and we've even got a couple of minutes with Owen Morgan on the 100. I'm Yaz Rana, and alongside me today, I'm with a magazine editor of the Wisden Cricket Monthly magazine. That's out today, listeners. Joe Harmon, how are you, Joe?
I'm good, yeah. Absolutely roasting, but otherwise good.
But 20 quid richer as well today.
Don't talk about that. It's a long-standing bat ahead with Phil Walker. I said about 6-7 years ago that Boris Johnson would become our Prime Minister. Not hoping that that would come about, I should add, but obviously today it has, and I am £20 richer, but a lot more depressed.
Moving on, we are delighted to have two very special guests with us. Tom Hewlin, the author of Keeping Up, a book about the art of wicketkeeping, inspired by Hampshire keeper Michael Bates' career. And we have Michael Bates himself. Thank you both for joining.
Hello there, how you doing?
Yeah, great. I think we're going to start with the Women's Ashes. Australia regained the Ashes with a lifeless draw at Taunton. Elise Perry, who scored her second consecutive Test century, helped Australia put on 420 for 8 in the first innings, rained ruined much of the second day. And then England needed quick runs to force a result on the third day, struggled, and Australia eventually batted out most of day 4 for the draw. We still have the 2020s to come, but the two teams are worlds apart at the moment, Joe.
It is unfortunately looking that way. At the start of the series, we did have our concerns that it might go this way. Australia are just a really, really strong side, and we saw that in the World T20 last year. They really raised their game, having lost the World Cup the previous summer. They just look a more polished outfit. Some of their players, someone like Alyssa Healy, who's been a good player for several years, is now an exceptional player. And Elise Perry, I mean, what do you say? She's just streets ahead of everyone else at the moment. And it's a tough old task for England. Obviously, the series is, well, the Ashes, they won't be getting back. They can still draw level, but there'll have to be quite a dramatic shift in form for them to get some points in this series.
Michael, you work with the England's women's side. What's your perspective from the inside?
It's been a really tough series for them, hasn't it? Leading into this series, their preparation overseas, this was seemingly good, but potentially just didn't get challenged enough. You know, England, Australia, very much the front runners in women's cricket at the moment. And as you said there, I think they've just been blown away a little bit.
Kind of the scary thing is, from an English perspective, that you have Meg Lanning's, Elise Perry's, but it's also the young players coming through are so good as well. Sophie Molyneux was, I thought, brilliant the way she bowled and then batted. Ash Garner hitting her second ball in the second innings with 6 looked brilliant. You work in the KSL. It's a very different competition to the Women's Big Bash. There are far more professional cricketers. So it's just hard for England to compete when you have talent balls that are so vastly different in size.
Yeah, it is. And, you know, that's always been the big contest, hasn't it? England, Australia, and a lot of things come into it. I think climate being one of them. They're able to play so much cricket all year round. And it's their system, certainly a women's game, is one that the ECB have tried to emulate. Because they're clearly doing a lot of things right. Not to say that we're not. And English women's cricket is going from strength to strength, without a doubt. And this will be a slight knock to that. But no doubt they'll pick themselves up and come back stronger, I'm sure.
Mark Robinson was reasonably defensive at the end of the game. He said that losing the toss was a big factor. But he also said that the only big difference between the two teams really is the athleticism. That's not through a lack of effort from our team. That's not lack of desire. They're just better athletes. You can't help that. God gives you physical attributes. I could send our whole group of 21 players to the WBBL. It won't make them better athletes. Tom, he's brought God into it.
Yeah, that's a bit Glenn Hoddle-esque, isn't it? That's a bit nerve-wracking. No, I mean, listen, I think in terms of the toss in the test, I think, you know, the damage was done in that, I think, that third ODI when they got sort of pretty annihilated, let's be honest. That puts huge pressure coming into a test, you know, where there's obviously points at stake. They had to win that game. And I think the sort of writing was on the wall from that ODI, which they lost so heavily. I mean, if we'd gone into the test 2-1, let's say it's not quite so bleak and such a must-win game, then the toss, like you said, that goes away from you. I know England were hoping to sort of bring Eccleston into it with the spin in the test. I know she got a niggle on day 1 as well, so Kirsty Gordon was sort of drafted in to bowl quite early on. She looked quite nervous. So you could say a few things conspired against them, I think, on day 1 in that test. And then you have rain, very difficult to recover after that. So I think, you know, there was a few factors that went against them, but ultimately Australia were the better side.
Yeah, even though it was a draw, I think Australia were much better side. But at the same time, England can still draw the Ashes. Australia retained them because they're the holders. But if England win the 3 T20s, they can draw the series. And Joe, do you think England will make changes? England have, by and large, kept the same 11 to 15 players that won them the World Cup 2 years ago. But is it time to try other young players coming through?
I thought they missed a trick a little bit with the squad for the one-day series. Not so much the test match, because that does lend itself to people who have played for many years and experience is really helpful. But I thought, I was surprised Sophia Dunkley wasn't part of the one-day side. I expect she'll come in for the T20s as she's played over the course of the winter. Bryony Smith's another one who's done really well in county cricket. It does feel that really they could have done with a bit more youthful dynamism just to kind of give that group a bit of freshness more than anything else. And they have looked a little stale, which is surprising because, as Michael said, they came in, it was 13 wins on the bounce in coming into this series. And I think it's indicative of where women's cricket is at the moment. The whole game is moving up rapidly at all levels, but Australia are just moving faster than everyone else. And the concern, if I was England, I'd be concerned about what India are going to do in the next few years as well, because the women's IPL, I think, is imminent in the next year or two. We've just done in the latest issue of Wisden Cricket Monthly a list of the top 25 women's cricketers in the world, sorry, best youngsters in the world, and four of the top 10 are Indians. So I really think we're going to see India progress and potentially become a kind of a superpower alongside Australia. So England are really going to have to work particularly hard to keep up with those two. Otherwise, you could become a sort of distant third in a relatively small field, which is no place to be.
And only one English player of the top 10.
Yeah, Sophie Eccleston was the only one in the top 10, really, because there aren't that many to choose from in the current setup. Dunkley was in that list, but a bit lower down, whereas the Indians in that list are key players in their sides. Australia actually only had two by comparison, so it's not a huge gulf, but a lot depends on how next year goes and what replaces the Kia Super League, because we know there's the 100, but there also needs to be a 20-over competition of some kind for the women. Details of that still aren't clear.
I mean, there are no details at all. We hear so much about what's going to happen, all the coaches in the men's 100 or whatever, but
well, this is always the problem with running together. It has a lot of advantages, but it also did raise alarms that the women's game would be an afterthought, and that does seem to be the case so far.
I couldn't help watching the game, and this might sound harsh, but Anya Shrubsole, World Cup hero in 2017, she was the sixth bowler used by Knight in the second innings. Georgia Elwis bowled ahead of her. Do you think that, I mean, it's been Shrubsole and Brunt for years in the England team.
Well, this is part of the problem, yeah. I mean, the seamers haven't. Katie George came in for the, 2 years ago and then got a serious injury. Freya Davis has been part of the T20 setup. But really, you'd hope for more pressure from underneath on Shrubsole and Brunt so that Shrubsole doesn't have to come on early. But that's not necessarily a problem because you've got the other options. But in the spin department, they look pretty well blessed. The seam, not so much.
I remember Mark Robinson saying earlier in the year that a problem with bringing through young female fast bowlers is that at a lower level the games are just dominated by spin. So they needed to implement a rule in a recent academy series where they had to force teams to bowl pace bowlers in the first six overs of the T20 because otherwise teams just weren't bowling for them. So that is, I think it is harder to bring through the younger fast bowlers, but as you say, lots of good spin options.
Michael, in the KSL, are there young seamers coming through with kind of international potential?
There are. There definitely, without a doubt, there's plenty of young girls coming through that have showed a lot of promise. I think the difficult thing is, you know, these young girls, to gain proper experience at that sort of level, they have to play international cricket. You know, where the men's game differs so much is that young players coming through have already gained so much experience at a really decent level at first class cricket. And that's the challenge that Robbo and you know, the ECB, the setup, face, is in order to get these girls exposed to that type of cricket, they've got no other option but to throw them into the international scene really early.
More positively, Michael, from your perspective, in Amy Jones and Sarah Taylor, England have two of the best wicketkeepers in the world. What makes them so good?
First of all, I completely agree with that. I think the two best keepers in women's cricket at the moment, without a doubt. What makes them so good? Both of them exceptional athletes for a start, something that we mentioned earlier. Amy Jones in particular, she's a proper workhorse and she's worked tirelessly, particularly at her keeping with me. And she's actually been flourishing recently with the bat as well. It's awesome to see her getting picked in the team regardless of whether she's keeping or not. And Sarah's probably is, you know, similar to me in a respect, stereotypical proper keeper, and her instincts and just her natural ability with her hands to kind of change the game alone warrants her side.
We'll get more into wicketkeeping later on. But on that, you said it's a natural ability. Can that be coached? Can you coach a Sarah Taylor?
You can. I think you can enhance what they've already got. I'm constantly trying to work with Sarah on kind of her technique, if you like, and her positioning, head position in particular. But ultimately, she does what she does because she is just a bit of a freak. Ultimately, you know, her hands are exceptional, as I said, and she just gets away with at times average positioning purely because she is blessed, if you like.
And can you accept that in the sense that, in bowling terms, Muralitharan and Malinga, you wouldn't try and change them because they are what they are, and maybe Steve Smith as a batsman, again, wouldn't work for 99.9% of people, what works for him. Is the same true of keeping? Can you be like, that works, or there are certain things that you have to step in and go, well, that's not sustainable?
Well, ultimately, if it works, it works, isn't it? And you, that's one thing you can't argue about Sarah. She's found something that works so well for her, and she's still flourishing at the highest level within the women's game. I always refer to like MS Dhoni, someone like that, perhaps not at the top of his game now, but when he was, you know, technically he wasn't a model that you would aspire to be like as a kid, for example, but his natural ability, particularly stood up to the stumps, and his natural instincts, you know, just make it happen for him. And Sarah's very similar.
The biggest news in international cricket this week was Zimbabwe suspension from the ICC. All payments to Zimbabwe from the ICC have been frozen and they can't compete in any ICC events. Four Zimbabwe players who are due to take part in the ICC's Women's Global Development Squad tour of England to play against some KSL teams have been barred from travelling. Officially, the ICC have suspended Zimbabwe for failing to ensure there is no government interference in its running of the sport. ICC chairman Shashank Manohar said that what has happened in Zimbabwe is a serious breach of the ICC constitution and we cannot allow it to continue unchecked. They've issued a punishment after the entire Zimbabwe cricket board was suspended by the government's Sport and Recreation Commission last month and was replaced by an interim committee. The ICC says that it will review its decision at a board meeting in October. Now, we'll be doing a special episode next week on the Zimbabwe situation, speaking to senior figures around Zimbabwe cricket, so we'll keep it short today. But Joe, it's really sad, isn't it? The players are the ones who are being punished.
That is tragic, and you see Sikander Raza, who's been a kind of figurehead for Zimbabwe cricket for a while now, and been outspoken about the 10-team World Cup and other issues in the game, and is obviously an intelligent guy, and he's heartbroken for himself, for his teammates, for the game in the country. And it's not so very long ago that Zimbabwe were a relatively successful cricketing nation with some exceptionally talented cricketers. So that it's come to this is hugely depressing. To be completely honest, I'm still a bit conflicted on it. Obviously, it's tragic, but I need to know more about why the ICC have done this and what details have particularly led to this to know whether it was a just punishment. That will obviously come to that on the Zimbabwe special. We were talking earlier about this the group of young women's cricketers. Remind me of the name, Yaz? The
Women's Global Development Squad.
So the Women's Global Development Squad had, I believe, four young Zimbabwe women in it, and they've now said that they can't compete in that squad. Now, for me, that doesn't make sense.
That has nothing to do with Zimbabwe cricket. They're just Zimbabwean.
They happen to be from that country. To me, without knowing anything about the law, that sounds like potential discrimination. Also, it sounded like an opportunity to offer an olive branch to Zimbabwe to say, look, the situation up top is horrendous. This can't continue. But we still think Zimbabwe has a future as a cricket nation. So to ban four young female Zimbabwean cricketers from taking part at all seems pretty counterproductive and quite depressing, really.
Grant Flower said in an interview with Quick Info that perhaps the ICC's decision isn't based on just what they've said they've made the decision on. It might be an accumulation of many years of financial mismanagement for the Zimbabwe Cricket Board, that from the ICC's perspective, they're giving the Zimbabwe Cricket Board a lot of money and they're bailing them out a lot and they're not seeing anything for that money. As I said, we'll go into that in more detail next week. But a final word on that from Sikander Raza himself, who told Quick Info, I don't know where we go as international cricketers. Is it club cricket or no cricket for us? Do we just burn our kits and apply for jobs? I don't know what we have to do right now. Pretty powerful stuff. Very sad. Elsewhere, England have named their 11 for the Ireland Test match that starts, for you guys listening, today. Ollie Stone and Jason Roy will debut. Gregory misses out. Tom, what do you think about that?
Yeah, for me, you know, after the World Cup that Roy's had, he's got to be given a chance at the top of the order. I know it's a different ball game, it's a different format. Aussies are going to line the slip cordon and the gully position up good and strong for Roy, flashing outside off. But I think you've got to give him a go, because I think if he comes off in the Ashes, he could be absolutely destructive for us. Joe Denley also at three. You know, he's played very well for Kent so far this season. So, yeah, another good call there as well.
Ollie Soane over Lewis Gregory. What do you think about that, Joe?
I'm not surprised I haven't picked Gregory, just looking at the makeup of that squad. I'm not sure he'd have had a huge amount of bowling to do. Ollie Soane, I was a little bit surprised that he got picked for this squad, given he hasn't bowled a huge amount this year and has a history of injury problems. I thought Jamie Overton might be the one that they go to, who seems to have done really, really well this year. And from the clips you see on Twitter, he looks to be bowling pretty rapid. So I thought that might have been an opportunity to give him a go. I think it's a really big test match for Stuart Broad, which sounds odd for a bloke who's played as many test matches as he has, playing against Ireland, no disrespect meant, but you know, this is not one of the lead test nations, but it could dictate how Broad's summer pans out.
On Soane, it's a real show of faith they selected him for Sri Lanka. He's been injured basically in the entire time since Sri Lanka tour. I think he actually could play in the Ashes, because Wood's not going to play at least till the fourth test match. Archer's not going to play at least till the second test match, apparently. And England, for so long, were talking about the need to have fast bowlers coming through. Suddenly two come at once, and now they're both injured. Michael, do you think there's any chance that Soane might play in the Ashes? I think that's why they've selected him for the test match, because they want the pace.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think they've got to give him a go, haven't they, initially against Ireland, to see what he's got. And as you said, he's been out a long time injured. I'm sure he'll come back stronger than ever. It's an interesting one, isn't it? You mentioned Broad, you mentioned Anderson. It's been those two for so long. And now we're actually blessed to have, as you say, like a plethora of really decent, strong, quick bowlers coming through. It's a great place for English cricket to be, but it'll be interesting to see how they move things forward.
Elsewhere in the bowling department, Jack Leach is playing again. He's quietly had another stormer of a county season. He's got 29 wickets and 19. We're playing two spinners at the moment. I think that's partly because Moeen's going to probably be batting at six, but given the weather we've got at the moment, we could be playing two spinners further on in the summer. But also, if we play one, is it as done and dusted as people have been assuming, that Moeen will play ahead of Leach?
I don't think it's done and dusted. We saw over the World Cup that England were prepared to drop Moeen when it didn't suit their team strategy. His batting hasn't really been particularly strong for quite a while now. He does bowl well in England in test matches. That he's got a proven record, so they'll give him every chance, I think. But Leach just does it every time for Somerset, doesn't he? Did Leach coincide with you in your spell at Somerset, Michael?
He did, and I've grown up actually playing with Leach. So Leach would have been part of the under-19s England team, which I'm sure we'll go on to discuss a little bit later. But I know Jack very well, and he's an absolute hero. He's a great man. So he doesn't just bring his bowling attributes to a team. He's brilliant around the change room. So I'm thrilled to see him doing well.
He's great for cricket badges out there as well, because you can tell he just loves it so much.
Absolutely loves it, yeah. Exactly. And it's good, isn't it? It's great to see under such pressure. You know, Ashes test match, if he plays, he'll still be out there loving doing what he's doing. So it's great to see.
And you can say he's pretty unlucky not to have played a home test match yet, given his record in England over the last few years.
Yeah, absolutely. Mark, as you alluded to, you're in the same under 19 side as the World Cup heroes Ben Stoke, Butler, yep, Root, James Vince.
Tidy team.
Yeah, you guys only got to the quarterfinals. What went wrong?
And I think, notoriously, under-19s have struggled, I think, in World Cups, despite, you know, the quality of players that they've had coming through the ranks. But we had a proper team. Yeah, Joe Root as well was in that team. Azim Rafiq, who was playing at Yorkshire not long ago. He was a very good player at that age as well. We had a serious side.
Was it clear then that Stokes, Butler, Root in particular would go on to become the phenomenal players they are now?
Stokes and Butler, definitely. Root was a very, very good player, very technically sound. He had limitations to his game at that age. He was, you know, he's quite slight, he was quite small, as a lot of lads are at that age. So it was quite clear he would have to expand his game to become the player he is now. But he's always a standout technically.
And what about Stokes as a character? All the England team now talk about him as kind of being the engine room of that dressing room, being an incredibly hard worker, an amazing team man. Was that all that stuff evident even at under-19 level?
Yeah, with Joss and Stokes, I would say, very, very similar characters. You know, larger than life, similar to Jack, actually, just love doing what they're doing. They work tirelessly at their game, completely professional, but know how to have a really good time off the field. So considering how talented they were at that age, considering the sort of characters they were at such a young age then, it's no surprise actually to see them properly dominating world cricket now.
I was looking back through a couple of scorecards from that. It's the 2010 under-19 World Cup. And I think you were batting with Stokes when he got his 100, or certainly during his 100. So he got 100 off 88 balls against India. Yeah. And I remember that knock, seeing it on Sky, and it being the sort of moment where a lot of people woke up to the fact that we had a pretty special talent about to arrive.
Absolutely. And that was against India. It was a must-win game for us. It was the last group game of the tournament. As I said, we had to win to go through to the quarters, where we'd meet West Indies. Jason Holder actually rolled through us that day. But it was an exceptional knock, again, under quite a bit of pressure.
Tom, talk to us about your book.
So, Keeping Up is a book about Batesy's career. You know, his time at the Hampshire age groups, but also the England age groups, as we've just mentioned, coming up, playing against some of the best lads in the game in the country at the time. And it's about his journey through the game. And it's about wicketkeeping more generally as well, I suppose, is the other key strand. So the changing role of the wicketkeeper in modern cricket, that need to, you know, to bring runs to the party, as well as, you know, good work behind the stumps. And it really just talks to a lot of people within the book, not just Batesy, but Joss contributes, Joe Root, even Adam Gilchrist talks to us about what they see as being the most important part of a wicketkeeper's role. And I suppose the interesting thing with Gilly was that he was, you know, an absolute wicketkeeper through and through. His keeping was the most important part of his game, to him. So if he'd kept well and his batting hadn't gone so well, he was still pretty happy. But if his batting had gone well but his keeping had struggled, he was pretty depressed, wasn't he?
So it's quite ironic that he's the guy who changed it all for wicketkeepers, really, as the pre-Gilchrist era and the post-Gilchrist era.
Absolutely. Yeah, and I think that was one of the biggest surprises, I suppose, from all the people that we spoke to was how Gilly, you know, was really passionate about his keeping, and he's obsessed about his stats behind the stumps. And for him, that was the most important thing of his game, which was a real fascinating insight for us.
Michael, you were a key part of one of the best white ball team, the best white ball team in the country in your early 20s. And whilst you batted lower down the order, you were a key part of that team as a specialist keeper. Do you think that wicketkeeping nowadays is undervalued as a skill in white ball cricket in particular, considering how crucial you were to that team?
Well, my obvious answer is yes. It's an interesting debate, because actually you could argue, and I think speaking to Bruce French, he mentioned this when we spoke to him for the book, in terms of Red Bull cricket, so the longer format of the game, the keeper's kind of, he's affecting the game more than he would potentially in a white ball game. You know, he touches the ball more often, so you could argue that actually having a specialist keeper in the Red Bull game is just as important. I guess also the flip side to that is the white ball game. You could go a whole 20 overs or however long it is without your keeper necessarily touching it that often, you know. But as the need for a shorter form of cricket becomes more apparent, the need for batters lower down the order is I'd imagine just going to fizzle out. So in that instance, playing a specialist keeper would probably benefit your team.
There are stats such as the average number seven in a T20 faces five balls.
Exactly. Yeah.
So you're better off, surely, having a keeper that gets you on average a dismissal a game.
Well, exactly right. And so you mentioned the team that I played in at Hampshire. I was standing up pretty much for the majority of the innings, almost all of the innings, whoever was bowling. And, you know, the pressure you can apply to a batter by doing that and doing it well, obviously, is priceless, I think. And if like me, you're going to be batting, you know, 7, 8, 9, as you've said there, the chances of you actually being able to influence the game with your bat is very unlikely.
Because your elevation to the side came very young as well. You won the T20 Cup 2010, so you were still only, what, 19?
19.
And then again in 2012?
Yep.
And then actually I was looking at that you won the Clydesdale Bank 40 in 2012, which I was looking back at that match, Mark Nicholas described it as the best performance by a keeper he's ever seen, which, I mean, obviously he's a Hampshire boy, but but that from coming from Mark Nicholas, who's seen a hell of a lot of cricket in a lot of the world, that's quite a statement to make. And I, just without wanting to embarrass Michael, like, you see so many good keepers these days, and you see so few mistakes, but you still don't see that many keepers who kind of change a game as a wicketkeeper. Jack Russell's obviously one classic example. James Foster's another. But I remember watching those games, and you would influence a game. It was like that those opportunities weren't even necessarily apparent. Sarah Taylor's another one, weren't necessarily apparent to other keepers. And I think a lot of people lament that is has perhaps left cricket to a certain degree, but as you say, might come back in.
Yeah, how did you get to the level where you was standing up to everyone. How does that happen?
I think you just go for it. You just go for it and see what you can do.
You think more keepers should do that now in white ball cricket?
Yeah, you've got to be confident in doing it. I think, like most things within cricket, it's a mind game, isn't it? So unless you're doing it with the utmost confidence and knowledge that you can do it, you've got to prove it to yourself initially. But you can't just kind of send yourself up there and hope for the best, because it won't work. And as we said countless times now, actually being able to affect the game with your gloves, you've got to believe that. And if you're not looking to do that, it's going to go horribly wrong for you.
Then when you were 24, 25 and you found a contract hard to come by, I mean, obviously that must have been pretty disheartening. But also, were you very surprised considering how important you were to successful teams?
I think, I was quite young back then, quite naive, and possibly didn't value myself as much as I should have done. I think it came as a surprise to a lot of people around me that, that I wasn't kind of snapped up or offered a contract full stop. And it was gutting, yeah, definitely. And as you've mentioned already, our book, Keeping Up, goes into all of that, all the emotions that entailed and all the emotions that followed not being able to play professional cricket anymore.
Do you think we're now seeing T20 only contracts come in, given how crucial you were to Hampshire's T20 success? Do you think back then, if a T20 contract was around, that you might have got offered one of those, and that could have been a specialist T20 keeper potentially?
Yeah, quite possibly. And who knows? And with the introduction of the 100, again, it's a shorter format, isn't it? And for the reasons we discussed earlier, potentially someone like myself might have been able to play quite an important role in that, and especially if your attack, if your bowling attack is pace off or, medium pace attack, then I'm actually able to get up to the stumps and affect the game throughout the whole innings.
And what advice do you give if you're working? You said you work with some of the England Women's Academy players. If you see a really exciting keeping talent, but their batting isn't perhaps going to be kind of top level, from your own experience, would you encourage them to work more on their batting to try and even that up? Or would you, as the kind of purest keeper, say, go with the thing that you're most naturally talented at?
Well, I think you've got to do both, haven't you, ultimately? And if you've got that X factor with the gloves, you've got to play on that. You've got to make it a super strength like I did. But on the flip side, even if you're an exceptional keeper, you've got to be able to bat these days. You've got to give yourself that chance of competing with the bat as well. So it's a tough role. It's a tough role within the modern day game, because you've got such high standards to uphold with both skills.
Just jumping in there, I think what was really interesting when we spoke to the likes of Sam Billings and Joss Butler was, I mean, Sam Billings, at the similar age to Batesy when he started playing for Hampshire, around 19, he actually went to Loughborough University and almost took a break out of his time at Kent because he had two lads ahead of him that he wasn't going to displace. And he told us in the book that, I mean, he went to Loughborough and basically just nailed his batting. Just no pressure, just had fun with it almost, and really nailed it. And similarly with Joss, he was a straight batter until he was 13. And then he took the gloves because he knew he needed more to his repertoire, if you like. And I suppose it's just nailing those skills, isn't it? It's just giving yourself the best chance possible of breaking into the team. And I mean, even Joe Root was talking about that with his off spin. Just having something more than just your basics. And I suppose that's the balance, is, having an elite sort of specialist versus just trying to get your multi-dimensional skills in place, because that's what you need in the modern game.
I guess Butler would have played as a specialist bat in that under-19 side.
Yeah, he did. I didn't play in the quarter-final in the end, because I think Butler then took the gloves just for the sake of balance of our attack of our team. So I actually missed out in the quarter-finals. But we played in the same team together. But Tom's absolutely right there. You see it quite often now. You get a few keepers playing in the same team. Obviously, only one can take the gloves, but it just shows the amount of kind of multi-dimensional talent that's coming through, particularly in the keeping department.
Australia might have three on the Ashes side at this rate, with what, Wade, Carey, and Payne, who has to play because he's captain.
Well, we'll see how long that lasts. Well, that's really interesting. Tom, how do people buy the book?
So the book is available now on Amazon, $11.99. And yeah, get involved, please do.
I think we're going to have some competitions run through Wisden social media accounts as well to win a signed copy.
Very exciting. At the end of last week, Owen Morgan was at the draw for the Euro T20 Slam and spoke to myself and a couple of other journalists on a range of stuff, including, yes, the 100.
One of the formats will miss out. We can't play with four formats The 100, yes, I do think we need it. I think whether it's 100, 10 overs, 20 overs, I think one franchise tournament with less teams in order to consistently sell the game to the country, I think we need it. I think anybody I speak to who loves sport but not necessarily loves cricket is crying out for a tournament that he or she understands, because 18 teams going for a long period of time does not make sense to anyone.
Joe, what do you think about that?
Well, I think, as ever, Morgan's been very straight and honest, and I think what he's saying is perhaps kind of realising the worst fears of a lot of county fans who think that once the 100 is well established, the blast will just slip away, and the counties that hold that tournament very dear will be understandably upset by that, and also potentially out of pocket in the long run, although they're getting the kind of the handout as the 100 deal rolls on, because they have to play 50 over cricket in some form. That's the World Cup. You can't just pick it up every 4 years and hope to win a World Cup.
We've completed it now.
Yeah, we complete. Fine, good point. All right, move on.
Morgan's been called an ECB stooge, a company man.
It's just nonsense.
But yeah, I think A, he makes a fair point, and B, I think he does genuinely believe it.
He's never been any of those things as well. He was saying that players should be allowed to go and play in the IPL when that was very, very unfashionable, and other England players were getting into quite a lot of trouble for that.
The ECB also announced this week that they'll be announcing a new strategy that will aim to double state school primary school participation in cricket. They're acting quickly. They're building on the World Cup win, which I think is good from the ECB, if slightly overdue. On that Euro T20 slam, it's got some massive names in it, by the way. McCullum, Tahir, Rashid Khan, Mills, Babrizar, Mohammad Amir, Owen Morgan. Plenty more big names that I've not mentioned there. It's also likely to be on a mainstream UK sports broadcaster's TV channel too. It's exciting. It'll be a very weird tournament in front of, basically playing at club grounds in Scotland, Ireland,
with some of the really big names involved in it. Personally, I can't get my head around more cricket, but I don't know if that means that other people can't.
Well, it clashes. It's unfortunately a timed tournament. It clashes with the last two Ashes Test matches, the knockout stages of the Blast, which is a real issue for the Euro T20 Slam teams, considering how many players are playing in the Blast, and also the Caribbean Premier League. So, yeah,
I'm going to go with the Ashes, if that's all
yeah,
right.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, same.
I mean, I think it's an interesting one, isn't it? Because we were just talking about it on the way here. And, you know, some of the cities that these teams are based in, I mean, it's quite good, you know, for fans going for a weekend away in Edinburgh or Dublin or Amsterdam. You know, you can see some kind of appeal. But like Joe said, there's just so much cricket around. How do you squeeze it all in? Ireland, Scotland, Holland, obviously, you know, they've got, very good cricket followings and players and stuff, so in some respects it's a valiant attempt, but just where do you squeeze it in?
So the odd tournament, so you've got 30 round robin games, you have 10 in one city, 10 in the next, and 10 in the other, so you've got six teams, three of them they've got city names, their titles, but the games aren't played at those cities, and you've got 10 games at these cities in which cricket isn't massive. You're just not going to sell out even these tiny grounds, which is it's going to be an interesting one.
I feel like you know more about this tournament than anyone else out there.
I'm just really excited to see those people play cricket in Scotland.
The Rotterdam Rhinos?
Rotterdam Rhinos, yeah. The Edinburgh Rocks. I can't wait. The T20 Blaster started. We've had lots of games, but what have we learnt so far? AB de Villiers is quite good at cricket. He scored 88 not out against Essex. He should be playing for South Africa, shouldn't he, Michael?
I think you're probably right.
It's the leading question, yes.
I certainly think the South African team would agree with you.
Yeah.
Serious question. That was a bit facetious. The next year there is a T20 World Cup, right? He's playing so much T20 cricket. He's probably got more practice with the T20 format than anyone else in world cricket. And if he's playing so much, why can't he play one short tournament in November in Australia?
Well, he can and he should. And rather than it all being left to the last minute, they should sit down now and try and make up, because I think there is some making up that needs doing, and find out, first of all, if he has any desire to. And I suspect, given that he made that offer for the 50-over World Cup, that there is some desire to finish on a high with South Africa. And then get that deal done early and not leave it. I mean, I understood Cricket South Africa's point that they couldn't bring him in at the last minute and drop another player. Fair enough. But it all should have been discussed much, much earlier.
If you've not seen Tom Banton bat yet, change that right now. He looks incredible for Somerset. If you've not seen him bat, I was arguing with Taha Hashim in the office the other day about who he reminds us of. I think Butler he thinks KP, so I guess he's a cross between the two. He's just 20.
Sounds handy.
Yeah.
When you put it like that.
Some of the shots that he plays are incredible. There's one ball, a genuine top of off stump ball that he reverse slaps over third man for six.
Him and Babar Azam is a pretty, tasty pair.
Happy partnership. Yeah, he looks very exciting. I guess it's an interesting time for young players with the T20 World Cup next year and also the 100. So if you're an aggressive top order young batsman, 2020 is a great year for you. Spare a thought for Gloucestershire. They had Glamorgan 96 for 8 before the rain ruined that game. That ended in a no result. Spare a thought for Tom Curran, who after winning the World Cup in the same week, he went for 63 off his three overs against Essex. Cameron Delport scored 129 in a 15 over game. Essex scored 226 in 15 overs. That's insane. Elsewhere, there have been a couple of retirements. There's only been one retirement. We'll get to that. Lassie Malinga has retired. Well, he's doing the very shanking thing where he's going to play one game of a series and then retire. He's going to play against Bangladesh this Friday and then he's going to call it a day there and then in ODI cricket. He's a real great of white ball cricket. Only two bowlers have taken more World Cup wickets than him. Guys, simple question. What's your favourite Malinga memory? Start with you, Tom.
Yeah, well, I think with Malinga, he's just so iconic. That action, those searing Yorkers, you know. I wouldn't have one sort of outstanding memory as such, but just that delivery, I mean, that stock sort of delivery that he's just made his own. And I mean, I think the great thing about this amazing sport that we love is those sort of almost like freakish players that you just come around and they're just so amazing at what they do and they bring this uniqueness. And for me, that's Malinga all over.
And this year in the World Cup, when he was potentially slightly overweight and people were writing him off, he's still brilliant as well.
Yeah, I mean, he did a job on England, didn't he? For sure. Yeah. So he can, I think some players are just, you know, just superstars, and he's definitely in that sort of category for me.
Joe, guess that 4-4.
4-4 is the one that obviously sticks out. But I thought it was great. I mean, at the time, we were all a bit worried, but when he took apart England in that match, I mean, he saved the World Cup in many ways. The group stage would have been a bit of a snooze fest for the remainder if he hadn't done that. And as you say, I certainly didn't think he was fit enough to play in all Sri Lanka's games at this World Cup, and that's before I saw his belly. So,
and finally, Darren Stevens. It's been announced that the 43-year-old all-rounder will leave Kent at the end of the season, but he's not retiring. That is extraordinary, isn't he? He's currently on loan at Derbyshire in the T20 stuff, but he's not retiring. He still wants to go strong.
So Darren Stevens must have been quite an old bloke when you made your debut.
I know the Hampshire teams that I've played in, we've certainly fell victim to him quite a few times. A great, great cricketer. And he's kind of found his way again, hasn't he, of being so successful in all formats, really.
What's he like as a bloke? Because it must be something different about you to want to still play professional cricket at 44, which you will be at the start of next season.
Yeah, it's a remarkable effort, isn't it? From what I can see, he's a great bloke. I can't say I knew him really well, played against him quite a few times. But I've had this conversation with a lot of people. Generally, you know, players on the first class scene, they're all pretty decent blokes. You don't come across many wrong uns. And he's certainly one of them. You know, he's a very good bloke and still clearly very keen and passionate about cricket.
It's remarkable that to have that longevity when he is essentially a bowling all-rounder now as well. Yeah, I mean, his batting hasn't really fired for a little while now, and he's opening the bowling in Division 1. And I didn't think he's done amazingly over the years, but a lot of those wickets have been taken in Division 2, the vast majority. Mm. I wasn't convinced he'd be able to step up on those pitches and take wickets. But he's still doing really well for a Kent side that are playing above expectations as well.
Exactly. Thanks, Joe, Tom, Michael. Listeners, subscribe on the podcast app or Spotify if you haven't already, and we'll see you.